The Tom Woods Show, episode 1999.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, it does not matter where we are in the school year. It is never too late to join the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which will give your kids an unfair advantage and which features 400 videos on history taught by me. And if you do decide to join the curriculum, of course, join through my link, because through my link only will you get $160 worth of free bonuses. So check out my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We're going to be talking today to our friend Patrick Newman, who's a professor of economics not too far from where I live, Florida Southern College. He's got a brand new book in which he attempts to tell the story of cronyism in one book in American history. So going from 1607 to 1849, the book is Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849. And so this is a telling of the story of American history. It's a little bit different from the standard take that you ordinarily get. And you know I love stuff like that. So I'm going to talk about that today. But before we get to that, I want to say a word for our old friend Gene Epstein. Now, Gene was not able to be present at my 2000th episode event because of the bar mitzvah for his grandson. But he did record a wonderful greeting video that I played at the event. And I played it for the first time. I had never seen it. I had some of my people caption it. And I did that for most, if not all, of the videos, because sometimes the people applaud or cheer, then you can't hear what they're saying in the video. So we captioned them. So somebody saw the video to caption it, but I hadn't seen it. And Gene left just such a charming, wonderful, funny, slightly disparaging, but again, in a funny way, but very heartfelt video that I was very, very happy to see. And so that will be included when we release the 2000th episode in the next day or so. And again, I urge you to try to watch the 2000th episode. You know, make it a night in with your significant other, you know, and enjoy, because it's entertaining and a lot of fun. Anyway, Gene, of course, is the director of the Soho Forum, which does unbelievably important debates on topics of interest to libertarians. And they have been doing these debates for years in New York City, where they continue to hold them. But they also have a live stream option so that you can view these debates from anywhere in the world. And their upcoming debate, November 15th, 2021, is between Stephen Kinsella and Richard Epstein. And the resolution reads, all patent and copyright law should be abolished. And of course, Stephen is arguing in the affirmative, Epstein in the negative. And Kinsella says he's not going to be arguing it from a rights-based point of view. He's going to argue more or less from a utilitarian standpoint. And that's interesting because I think most people think that the IP issue is hard to defend from a utilitarian standpoint, that certainly IP, intellectual property law, is supposed to have good results. It will make people write more books or have more inventions and stuff like that. So Stephen is going to argue that that's not the case. He says, I'll be arguing at the Soho Forum that not only is IP law unjust, it actually impedes, stifles, and distorts innovation and literary and cultural endeavor. If you really want to promote the progress of science and useful arts by authors and inventors, as the U.S. Constitution says, abolish the state-imposed patent and copyright monopolies. So this is obviously not one to be missed. So check it out. The website is thesohoforum.org. And get yourself your live stream tickets wherever you are in the country and help support good old Gene Epstein, who's been such a friend to me and such a friend to the Tom Woods Show. And I want to be a good friend to him. So check out thesohoforum.org. All right, let's turn now to our friend Patrick Newman, and we're going to talk about cronyism. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
It was great to see you at the Supporters Summit and to see you with a pile of books around you and a whole bunch of people wanting to get them signed. Ah, reminds me of my younger years when I was a whippersnapper like you. So it's great to see you enjoying that success. When did I have my first? Yeah, I was older than you. Are you in your late 20s?
I am 30.
Oh, you reached 30. Okay.
I reached 30.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, you're still a youngster to me. So it's great to see you have this kind of success. So what a staggering undertaking to try to write the history of cronyism. What I like about it in particular is that this telling of American history doesn't sugarcoat things or give a comic book version of things like you might get in a textbook. You know, here we actually look at, well, who's benefiting from these particular policies? Which there are certain wealthy individuals who seem to enjoy a disproportionate benefit from this or that policy. Or the standard way they portray Hamilton versus Jefferson is that, well, Hamilton was a sophisticated financier, and Jefferson, of course, and his followers were stupid agrarians. What do they know about banking? And actually, they know a whole lot. If anything, I think they knew more than Hamilton. And a lot of that stuff comes through in your telling of the story. So I like, it has a very Rothbardian flavor to it, this book. So first of all, let's start with, explain us, I think we all have the basic idea of what cronyism is and how you would ever get the crazy idea to somehow try to chronicle the history of it.
Yeah, so those are good questions. So one, it was definitely enjoyable to be signing books and you know, speaking about it at the Supporter Summit. I was happy enough people were interested in buying the book and reading it. I hope it will be successful. I think it will be. Basically, the story of the book is that in the fall of 2018, Hunter Lewis, who is a donor at the Mises Institute, asked me to write a book on the history of crony capitalism. So to document, you know, the evolution of special interest legislation, when it increased, you know, more in certain periods than others, and all that stuff. So I started to work on it in the spring of 2019. And as I worked on it, I realized that I wanted to spend more time on early American history, particularly when you actually saw mass movement, you know, political organizations that were actually dedicated to eliminating cronyism. So this wasn't just a fringe sort of, oh, libertarian third party, et cetera, so on and so forth. You know, you actually had, the anti-federalists, you had the Jeffersonians, you had the Jacksonians, and they actually did get stuff done. So I wanted to describe these reformers as well as the bad guys. So you go to the good guys who are trying to fight cronyism and the bad guys. And so that's where this book, Cronyism, Liberty versus Power, came from. The actual sort of elevator pitch of the book is that I explain the history of cronyism during this time period from the framework of Rothbard's theory, liberty versus power. So there are people who are trying to fight cronyism. Those are the forces of liberty. And the people who are trying to encourage cronyism, those are the forces of power. So when the forces of power win, cronyism increases special interest legislation, central banking, protect tariffs, internal improvements, all that stuff. And when the forces of liberty win, when they take control of the government, cronyism declines initially, but then starts to increase because those reformers end up getting corrupted by power. They try to expand their own political base. They say, well, we need to pass our own special interest legislation and so on. And that, unfortunately, is what happened to the Jeffersonian and Jacksonian movements. And that's the story, the narrative that my book tells.
Let's go, actually, I want to go into the late 18th century and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. I want to jump right there. And we'll do some of this material. And as I mentioned to you before we started recording, given that your book goes all the way to the mid-19th century, I think we should have a separate conversation on some of the later topics. But let's start off with the controversy over funding the debt after the War for Independence. Now, this was a matter of, there was no absolute certainty that when the war was over, that these debt instruments people had piled up were actually going to be honored at their face value. And so some people had just unloaded them for whatever they could get for them, and speculators bought them up. And the speculators, of course, want, you know, expect it to be funded at par. And the speculators, of course, will put pressure on the new regime to fund it at par. And so some people felt like this is a windfall that these speculators won. If it is funded at par, then all these, you know, desperate, patriotic, but maybe impoverished farmers or whatever who were just happy to get rid of the things because they didn't know what was going to happen to them, these people kind of got the short end of the stick. On the other hand, you could say, but a speculator, you know, is somebody who bears a risk, and there was no assurance that the outcome would be like this. And moreover, the way the typical textbook puts it, why wouldn't you, if you want to establish the good credit of the new regime, why would you not start off by funding your debt at par? Otherwise, you would start off under the presumption that your regime can't be trusted. So isn't it just a matter of simple honesty to fund the debt at par? What do you think about that?
So that's a great question. I take the Rothbardian perspective on the national debt, or really any sort of government borrowing, federal, state, local, et cetera. It's a burden. It's unproductive because the government spends it not according to profit and loss. And of course, the government has to raise money to pay back its creditors through taxes. So it's different than a regular debt instrument, say if you buy bonds of a company that has a high risk, or bonds if it's a successful company, et cetera. And this is something, you know, Rothbard's best solution for this is not to actually pay off the national debt, but to get rid of the national debt, to default or to repudiate, right? That actually the weakening of the government's credit is actually a strength because it weakens its ability to borrow and to engage in various sorts of spending boondoggles and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, during the war, the colonists, the Patriots, basically funded the war operations through a variety of printing money and borrowing, you know, debt instruments, and they were given to a lot of farmers and merchants and soldiers, and they sold them. And then you had various speculators buy them up at these very low rates. Now, you could say that is just a regular market activity and there's risk involved, et cetera. But of course, what they were also trying to do, these individuals led by Robert Morris, who is the famous sort of merchant prince of Philadelphia, he was the intellectual or sort of the mentor of Alexander Hamilton. They were then pushing for, partially at the Constitutional Convention, but not really, and then more especially at the first congressional session, is to basically fund the debt at par, right? So they were able to buy the debt at low rates, and then they get the taxpayers to basically enrich them. And that's more or less what happened when you look at the debt funding compromise. Most of the debt was held, at least the available record suggests, by a very small group of northern speculators. And they were basically making millions of dollars off of this. And the debt, of course, was funded through taxes, either through protective tariffs and also through internal taxes, such as the whiskey tax, which fell on poor Westerners. So it was really a redistributive racket. And it was really crony because these people pushed for higher taxes. They pushed to get the government to assume the debt so then they could make money off of it. And this is something that's not always really understood, but this is a common cronyism throughout American history. We've done the same thing with investment bankers pushing for South American governments to raise taxes to pay their debt, et cetera, et cetera. It's an important instance of cronyism. And it's fitting that the United States government really started off by engaging in it.
I was impressed by the quotation you dug out from Thomas Jefferson. I want to shift the conversation to the First Bank of the United States, that you dug out from him at the time of the Panic of 1797. Because one thing I've found in writing about this is that when you look at what people are saying about banking in the U.S., let's say in the late 18th century, but more the early 19th century, it's surprising how many times you can find people kind of stumbling upon a primitive version of the Austrian business cycle theory. They have some sense that there's some kind of artificial stimulus being given to particular lines of production that isn't sustainable in the long run and eventually, like a sugar high, results in a crash. And so to see these glimpses, you know, of insight from 19th century people is very impressive. Now, having said that, I want to talk first of all about what is cronyist, or what is the crony angle of, let's say, the Bank of the United States? Because again, if you read this in, you know, your eighth grade history book, it'll say, well, you know, to provide for the financing that a young country needs, the blah, 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 blah. You know, you'll get the Bank of the United States press release, basically, is what they're going to have in the textbook. How is the Patrick Newman interpretation different?
Yeah, so that's a great question, you know, regarding Jefferson and his proto-Austrian business cycle theory, and then, of course, the crony nature of the Bank of the United States. One thing that's important to emphasize, and that I talk about this in my book, is that the actual corporate charter, a corporation, really emerged through cronyism. Of course, now we know that corporations per se are just regular market organizations, but in order to run a corporation back in the day, so to be able to have stockholders with the option of limited liability, you had to get a charter from the legislature, whether it was state or federal, right? So this was basically a license that allowed you to operate a corporation, but no one else, unless they also got a charter. And of course, you would bribe the legislature to get your charter, and then you would bribe the legislature again to prevent other entrepreneurs from getting charters. So the Bank of the United States was a federal charter, right? And what that meant is that it had a monopoly. The government agreed during its 20-year time it would not charter another federal bank. So already you have a monopoly. It has a monopoly on interstate banking, which means it can open up branches across state lines, and it wasn't just centered in Philadelphia. You know, the government owned about $2 million, one-fifth of its total capitalization, and you could purchase the bank's capital with government bonds, so that basically drove up the price of bonds. And the bank, with being this monopoly, it had various other privileges from the government. It could make loans to the government. It could make loans to favored Federalist institutions. And it was this really bad financial organization that evoked a lot of troubling memories of the old British corporations. You had this giant monopoly bank. It had government subsidies. It could make loans to various businesses and the government, as well as serve as the center of credit expansion for various state banks, which is what it ended up doing. And it was really a troubling organization that angered Jefferson and a lot of other, who you could say, quasi-anti-federalists.
I want to get on to what ended up happening with the Bank of the United States. So obviously there was a debate between primarily Hamilton and Jefferson over it, which took a largely constitutional turn in terms of the arguments made. But Jefferson was against the bank regardless of the constitutionality, so there's also that aspect of it. But can you explain why the Bank of the United States is not the Federal Reserve? You may say that it's a spiritual precursor, but it's not, it wouldn't be like what we have now.
Right. So traditionally with a modern central bank, there's a couple of characteristics. You wouldn't have the monopoly on banknotes. So commercial banks nowadays, they can't issue their own banknotes. Every banknote now is a Federal Reserve note, right? So the Bank of the United States did not have that characteristic, okay? Another characteristic of a central bank is it has to be a banker's bank. What I mean by that is that commercial banks, much like we keep our deposits at commercial banks keep their deposits or some deposits at the central bank. The Bank of the United States did this indirectly by basically it would collect a lot of state banknotes, and sometimes it would call them in for reserves and sometimes it wouldn't. And by not calling them in, it was, in a sense, granting loans to banks, okay? Another characteristic of a modern central bank is it has to be a regulator of banks, right? So you think of the Federal Reserve sets reserve requirements for banks, making sure they're holding enough capital and so on. Bank of the United States didn't really do this. Also, another characteristic of a modern central bank is it has to be a lender of last resort. The Bank of the United States did do this occasionally. It would make loans to various institutions and so on, but definitely not with the same type of intensity as the Federal Reserve. And then the last characteristic is it has to be conducting some sort of monetary policy or explicitly conducting monetary policy to try to adjust the money supply and interest rates to stabilize inflation and unemployment and all that jazz. And the Bank of the United States also didn't really do that, or at least explicitly. It tried to maybe indirectly engage in monetary policy, particularly the Second Bank of the United States, but that's farther along in the story. So it wasn't exactly a modern central bank, but neither was any really central bank back then. Think of the Bank of England. It really was considered a monopolistic centralized bank. Might make more sense because it was trying to slowly take over the banking system with its monopoly and its ability to compete with state banks that do not have an interstate branching ability.
All right. Now that, I appreciate that clarification because I think it's not really clear to a lot of people what really the differences are, but you're right. These early national banks we hear about are not making so-called monetary policy in the way we think of it. Yet, on the other hand, though, their activities can have, let's say, an outsized impact on the American economy as a whole. And you talk about where producer prices and other prices went in the 1790s with the Bank of the United States at the helm, more or less. I do want you to say a word, if you could, about, because you have a paragraph here, I'm looking right at it on page 92. Despite Hamilton's best efforts, Washington remained unconvinced, leaning toward a veto. But they had an ace up their sleeve. And what's the ace up their sleeve? This is very interesting.
Yeah. So this is one of my favorite little stories in cronyism, because I read this and I almost couldn't believe it. I tracked down the book was citing. I kept going through this and I said, wow, this is really interesting. It's basically the year before, as part of the debt funding compromise, what happened was Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton, they said, well, the capital will be located somewhere along the Potomac River in exchange for the assumption of state debts, right? So that was the big sort of compromise of the federal government to assume federal and state debts at par and so on. And so this was the Residence Act, where Washington was given the ability to choose the location of the capital, what we now know as Washington, D.C., somewhere along the Potomac. Now, what's interesting is that Washington wanted to put the capital somewhere there, but he wanted to move it outside of the boundary that they had stipulated in the Residence Act, right? So he wanted to move it a little bit outside of the potential array of locations he could put the capital. And the reason he wanted to do this is because he wanted the capital closer to his landholdings, right? So, of course, by having a capital closer to your landholdings, it's one, convenient for him, and two, it's also going to massively increase the value of your property. Anyone who's been to Washington, D.C. now knows that Washington's Mount Vernon estate is still there, and he's still got a big highway, in that it's a massive amount of land. If Mount Vernon was no longer there and that highway, you could build a lot of houses along it. Housing prices in D.C. would actually probably take a big hit, right? So Washington agreed to not veto the bank bill, because he was actually leaning towards a veto, if the Federalists allowed him to basically put the capital outside of the Residence Act. In other words, if the Residence Act was amended. So in other words, Washington succumbed to cronyism. He got corrupted by power, as I say, and he agreed to allow us to establish, or to allow Hamilton to establish the Bank of the United States in exchange for him getting a nice boost to his real estate property values.
Now, that does come as a surprise to people, doesn't it? I mean, it's not the sort of thing that, again, that you read in the standard version. It's incredible to me the way it kind of airbrushes a lot of this stuff. And even people who think, well, these textbooks are very left-wing, a lot of them are very left-wing, but they tend to be also very establishment in a lot of the ways they tell things. I mean, Hamilton is always the hero, and you don't hear little stories like the one you just heard. I don't know why. I mean, you do, now you start to hear that George Washington held slaves and stuff like that. Like, they'll go to that level, but that's as far as their sophistication will go. You don't dig up stuff like this. Now, for example, I want to give another example of the kind of thing that you, or analysis you have in here. Now, it's true that Hamilton doesn't get everything he wants in the 1790s. He doesn't get the subsidies that he wants to manufacturing, and he doesn't get, let's say, the array of internal improvements that he wants. But internal improvements is the kind of issue that in the textbook, it's, well, only an idiot could be against this, because this is a matter of bringing the country together and making transportation less hazardous and more efficient. And, you know, who could possibly be against government-funded programs like that, and all, and so on and on. But now here's the kind of paragraph I read in your book. This is page 102. During the 1790s, Federalists wanted to use the Constitution to construct internal improvements and protect speculators' land claims. Well, already we're seeing a little bit of a different take on this. The policies were intricately linked. Speculators bought public lands and then pushed for government transportation projects, whether on the federal or state level, to raise the value of their holdings. Prominent Federalists engaged in this practice, including Morris, Robert Morris, who stuck his hand into nearly every special interest racket, and then you go on from there. So now that's rather a different way of looking at the situation, that maybe there's something other than an eye to the common good going on here.
Yeah, exactly. It's always seen as it's the public interest as well. You've got to stimulate output, and there's various public goods that the market clearly, of course, could never provide, which is factually incorrect. As I go through in the book, I provide various examples of private funded or more private funded internal improvements, roads, canals, turnpikes, bridges, et cetera, that it clearly shows you didn't need government investment or government spending to facilitate construction of those transportation projects and so on. But this land speculation is also a very neglected motive that people don't really look at when they're discussing the internal improvements issue. Washington wanted a stronger government that had taxing power to fund internal improvements. Why? Well, because he held stock in prominent Virginia canal companies, as did other prominent politicians such as Robert Morris, who you mentioned, and I go through how they basically were able to push for favorable policies on the federal and state level regarding either land grants or the construction of postal routes or, you know, so on and so forth, that really shows how they pushed for these projects so that their own land values would increase. That's, in my opinion, that's clearly cronyism. There's nothing public interest about that. You're looking to enrich yourself at the expense of the taxpayer.
Hey, folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Skillshare. Now, you've heard me talk an awful lot about Skillshare. As a matter of fact, in the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, coming out tomorrow, you'll hear that in our Family Feud game, one of the questions was, name something you associate with Tom Woods. And one of the responses somebody gave was Skillshare. Well, right now, I'm speaking in particular to all of you who have heard me talk about this and haven't given it a try yet. They're giving my listeners a free month of premium membership that gets you access to thousands and thousands of classes on topics ranging from illustration, design, and photography to animation, productivity, entrepreneurship, marketing, and more. And you'll find all kinds of subgenres within these categories. For example, gardening, creative writing, sign language, and way, way more than I can list. You'll find classes for every skill level, and they're short and to the point, so you don't have to put your life on hold to complete them. You'll create real projects and get the support of fellow creatives like you, so you can accomplish real growth. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/Woods, where our listeners get a 1 month free trial of premium membership. What have you got to lose? Give that a shot. You're going to love it. 1 month free at Skillshare.com/Woods. Let's move ahead. There's an episode in your next chapter, also the 1790s, the Whiskey Rebellion, 1794. And Rothbard is a bit of a revisionist on this, in the sense that the usual version of this is that this was a case of there were some, you know, there was a pocket of tax resistors, and here we have federal supremacy, you know, being felt because the federal government marches in there and they suppress the Whiskey Rebellion, and that's the end of that. And Rothbard's view is no. The Whiskey Rebellion was way more extensive than that, and everybody involved has a vested interest in keeping it quiet. The actual rebels, you know, probably don't want their names out there. And the federal government doesn't want its humiliation to be particularly known. So it wasn't until somewhat recently that we really got the much, much more interesting story of the Whiskey Rebellion. So tell us a little bit about that. And how does it fit into a story about cronyism?
Yeah, so that's one of my favorite episodes in early American history, because it goes through, yeah, after we established the Constitution, there was a serious rebellion. It wasn't just in Western Pennsylvania. It was all along the West, and it had to be subdued with an army, of course, not actual fighting, more of just intimidation, but that's the same, you know, in a sense, it's coercion nonetheless. And of course, you always find these details out. It's like the Kennedy assassination. Like, we're eventually going to get the whole story, but by the time we do, you know, everyone will be long gone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it will be, you know, won't be in the current events, so to speak. Well, so the Whiskey Rebellion really emerged from, in a sense, it directly related from the debt funding racket, which is that in order to fund the state government debts, the federal government needed to raise money beyond tariffs. Now, Hamilton didn't want tariffs to be super high, but he wanted them to be just high enough, and he was also looking for other ways to raise money. So despite him saying that, well, in the Federalist Papers, before the Constitution was ratified, that the government wouldn't rely too much on internal taxes, such as a tax on the production of whiskey. It would rely on mainly tariffs that were supposedly less burdensome, et cetera. And of course, now, after the Constitution is ratified, Hamilton sort of goes back on that, contradicts what he wrote anonymously in the Federalist Papers, and pushes for higher taxes on whiskey. And many farmers in the West didn't like this, because they said, hey, wait a second, this is just going to fund the debt that's owned by a bunch of rich people in the East. And Westerners, they weren't really attached to the government in the East too much. Many of them wanted to form their own government, et cetera, because they could just ship goods. They actually mainly just tried to ship goods through the Mississippi, down the Mississippi River. And so in a sense, the whiskey tax emerged from the debt funding scheme. And of course, once the whiskey tax emerged, the natural step you'd say is that, well, people are going to collect the tax, it's going to be enforced, et cetera. But Westerners weren't exactly really too keen on that. So the tax went unpaid, it went uncollected. Hamilton started to get really mad. He said you needed to raise an army to stop various protests that had been emerging, this basically localized nullification of the whiskey tax. And that's in fact what happened, that once there was enough of a rebellion, Hamilton and Washington sort of dragooned this massive army, bigger than I think an army Washington had controlled at Yorktown during the American Revolutionary War. And they sent it to Western Pennsylvania to intimidate people. And then that was that, right? So that kind of showed that, well, a lot of people weren't too happy with the new government. They weren't too happy with taxes. But as we know, taxes are coercive. And if you don't pay, Uncle Sam will make you pay the easy way or the hard way.
So that's I always enjoyed telling that story to students because inevitably their textbook is still telling them the version that we were telling in 1970. You know, there was some scattered people in Western Pennsylvania, and that was the end of that story. But it's just Rothbard. Rothbard was giving voice to the new wave of scholarship on this to say that, no, there was total resistance to the tax in the entire backcountry, and in large part because nobody dared to be a tax collector of this tax in these huge areas. So I used to love being able to tell students, look, I'm telling you stuff that your parents don't know and your friend who's studying this at Harvard isn't going to be told. And, you know, so I would get into their little teenage rebellious heads and, you know, occasionally make a little progress that way. Now, as I say, I think there's just so much to talk about here that we would be better served if we spent another episode on it. But before we bring this one to a close, of course, Jefferson gets elected in 1800, and it's sometimes referred to as the Revolution of 1800. They're getting rid of the Federalist Party that had been, you know, in power since the very beginning, and now Jefferson's party is in control, and Jefferson has very different priorities, and we see that in terms of taxation and other things. But just give us a sneak preview. What kind of a path does cronyism take under a relatively laissez-faire Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah, so Jefferson is always one of those presidents that I have, it's almost like a schizophrenic reaction to, where I think his first term was all things considered, pretty good. I disagree with the Louisiana Purchase, or at least how it was consummated, you could say. But other than that, he downsized the Federalist judiciary. They lowered, the Congress lowered taxes, cut government spending. Relatively good on military. There was the war against the Barbary pirates, but overall, it was at least as a downsize in the military relatively compared to the Federalist years. The Bank of the United States wasn't removed, but at least it had been more privatized, so on and so forth. That's, you know, the beggars can't be choosers, I guess, when it comes to libertarians ranking American presidents. So the first term is pretty good. Now, he didn't go as far as some of the radicals known as the old Republicans, guys like John Taylor and John Randolph wanted during this first term. That was because Jefferson was always trying to cater to the Federalists. He wanted to bring them into the Republican fold. And so Jefferson, in ways, sort of got corrupted. He wanted to expand his political base. I provide various examples of that. But the second term of Jefferson's presidency is an absolute disaster. It's one of the worst, right? Because you have the Embargo Act, you have him basically pushing for a quiet, you know, war against Canada, raising tariffs for manufacturers. He's supporting internal improvements. He's trying to engage in maneuvers to take over Florida. There's the whole Yazoo land claims, which he's siding with speculators. All of this stuff, all of these bad policies, you think of yourself, how do you get this left turn? You know, why did he completely do a 180? And the answer, I'm trying to argue, is it comes from the Louisiana Purchase, this massive acquisition of land that once we brought it formally into the United States, there was this tendency to centralize. Because if you have a larger and larger country, an empire, as I call it, there's a tendency for it to become an empire of power and not an empire of liberty. Jefferson originally wanted an empire of liberty, various, you know, decentralized confederacies that would sort of be informally united under a common language and customs, But by the end of his term, his second presidency, when he left office in 1809, it really become much more of an empire of power.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849. I will link to it at tomwoods.com/1999. You budding historians need to know the material in this book. Congratulations to Patrick Newman, who is just these days makes me feel like a lazy bum with all the things he's working on. Are you, when you finish a book project, you know, you've just done something really exhausting and, you know, you might be inclined to take some time off before starting any new projects, but I can't help asking, do you have any other projects in mind?
Yeah. So my next project I'm working on is my memoirs. No, I'm kidding. I'm not working on my memoirs. Not doing that. So actually I'm working on a manuscript with Joe Salerno. We're almost done with the rough draft. It's about 170 pages or so. We want it to be around 150 when it's all said and done. It's on the history of Rothbard's evolution as an economist in the 1950s and the early 1960s. So him working with Mises and writing Man, Economy, and State. So we go through the evolution of Man, Economy, and State, how it started off initially as a textbook rendition of Mises's Human Action, but then Rothbard wrote his full-blown, his own treatise, and how he built upon Mises' system and how he corresponded and interacted with other economists of his day, such as Milton Friedman and other members of the Chicago School. That we're hoping for is, you know, it would be released sometime in early 2023. The Making of a Misesian Economist is sort of the tentative working title. That's what we're working on now. Of course, I would like to continue the story of cronyism, go through later periods, Civil War, the Progressive Era, the Roosevelt era, you know, the New Deal and all of that. If there's enough demand for the first book, you know, I'm really familiar with that type of history. And then I've got some other side projects working on. I'm still working on this big meatpacking paper, going through the history of the Meat Inspection Act of 1906 and all of Upton Sinclair's lies and all that stuff. So there's a couple things in the pipeline. And with any luck, they'll all see the light of day.
Well, sounds excellent. And of course, we'll have to talk about all future Patrick Newman projects here on the Tom Woods Show. So check out tomwoods.com/1999. You can get a link to Patrick's book, Cronyism. So Patrick, maybe a month or so, we'll do it again.
Absolutely.
Okay, everybody, that's going to do it. So that means the next episode you see is going to be episode 2000. So again, I'm just telling you, there is a little bit of language in it, and there are a few little corrections I'm going to make, or there are people who I feel like didn't get proper introductions. I'll give them the proper introductions. But otherwise, the thing stands on its own, and I think you'll enjoy it. Now, it's long. It went way longer than I thought it would. Everybody went over their allotted time. But there's no part of it that I would say, yeah, we should just take this out. It's all good. You know, listen to it in shifts, or, you know, watch some of it one night and watch the rest the next night. You're not going to be bored, because it's all fun and funny with people we all respect. So look forward to that. And please consider becoming part of my community. But an event like this costs way more than you think to put on. Okay, whatever you think it costs five times that. Okay, and I'm able to do that and throw a huge party like this for our people so that we can all go out and be normal together, because I have good people like the folks listening right now who support the Tom Woods Show, who made that possible. And I would love to invite you to be part of my community, the supporting listeners of the Tom Woods Show, who have access to the Tom Woods Show Elite, the greatest no-censorship discussion group in the world. So if you've been, that little voice in your head has been nagging you to do this, well, it's about time to succumb to the urging of that voice. So head over to supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.